Thanks for coming. And it's a pleasure to have you all here for the second part of our series with Rabbi Angel. I would want to thank John and Marion Getzler Kramer for sponsoring this lecture in memory of Marion's father, Mr. Abraham Getzler, Meshamesh Haven Aliyah. And I also would like to take this opportunity to thank all the sponsors of this whole series. As you know, our shul's cultural campaign and lecture series throughout the year are really sponsored by individuals, and it's because of people like the sponsors over here that we're able to have this. Thank God I didn't have to ask anybody for anything. They all volunteered. So you can learn from all of our friends, and so Dailach Kima Baramiza. This week's topic by Rabbi Angel is Kohelet, confronting religious challenges.
Yeah.
Wrong. How do you like that? Okay. That's right. You know, I have to stay on script. I have it all over here, and then I take a look at this. Yeah. So it's elevating our struggles. And by with EO, and without further ado.
Okay, thank you, Avi. Thank you again, all, for coming. Somewhere on the F train tonight, you know, it's underground, so I didn't know exactly when Shkia happened or when Seid happened, but all of that happened while I was underground, and it stopped being Tezayin Mar Cheshvan and started being Yudayin Mar Cheshvan. So I knew that somewhere in there that transition had taken place, and by the time I came out, on the subway it was dark, so I'm like, okay, it's definitely Yudayim Mar Cheshvan right now. Yudayim Mar Cheshvan, according to the Shita, the Chodesh HaSheni in Parshat Noach equals Mar Cheshvan. There's a machloket, of course, because it depends whether the Torah uses that terminology from the beginning, from using Tishri as the starting point, or whether it's already starting with Nisan, based on the later Israelite calendar, it's unclear. So this could be right now the anniversary of when the Mabul started. So I thought about that. I also am conscious of that particularly because it's also my birthday. And I can't think of any, and what better way to celebrate one's birthday than to come and give a shiur about terrible and painful and unwarranted suffering. So I'm really delighted to be back in honor of the occasion, and thank you to the sponsors, to Avi, and of course to the rabbi in absentia for making this all possible. The first time I ever gave a shiur on Iyov, Iyov is one of the three courses I don't teach at YU, along with Mishlei, which we did last week, as well as Daniel, which we talked about. I just don't want to wap into that, which I certainly will. But hopefully you're hearing me, and hopefully whoever's trying to record whatever they're trying to record, it's all working out just fine. At some point I will wap the microphone with my hands, because that's, you know, we talk with our hands, and that's what happens. The shiur that I gave on Iyov, or the original one that I gave for the first time, was in 1999. It was the worst and most horrible shiur I ever gave. I gave it on a practical, I gave it for a practical reason, namely an 8-year-old girl in our community had just died of a brain tumor. It was a horrible, horrible case. I can't imagine a good case in this situation. I'm still very severely scarred by this, and I can't even imagine, you know, may God have compassion on the parents and the family for what happened over there. She was an 8-year-old kid. I'd known her since she was born, had a good relationship with her all the way through. I thought she was sweet, you know, even before she became ill. And then, unfortunately, she died relatively quickly, as these things go. And at the Shiva, I heard different rabbis speak about different things. They didn't quite speak to my style of how I was responding to it. And I spent the whole week just jumping into Sefer Iyov. I'd never learned it with any degree of depth other than a college course that I took, but I never had learned it because I never taught it. And I thought that there's no other book that I should be reading right now, so that was my therapy of sorts. So this shiur is obviously a much more ironed out version because I've had more chance to think about it, and it's no longer in its practical sense, but there was a very raw emotion that came.
Is it on?
I feel like it's on.
Nope.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right. Oh, now I feel like it's on. This is a totally different experience. In the meantime, of course, I'm still rattled whenever I think about Sefer Iyov, but of course that's just the point. Chazal discussed when Iyov took place. And it's a fascinating discussion in source number one. Hopefully you all have Mikorot. Also, I know you're bringing in seats, and that's always encouraging and good, but and nobody likes to sit in the front rows, but there actually are seats available in the front rows as well. One opinion is that Iyov lived at the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. Ravamar, Iyov bimei meraglim haya, which is also the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. Yitiv ahu mirabanan kamed rab Shmuel bar Nachmani, v'yitiv v'kamar, one anonymous rabbi here said, Iyov lo haya v'lo nivra ela mashal haya. In fact, the story never took place, but it's all a parable. That's already a very different point of view, that he lived, but he lived in the time of the Second Temple period. Okay, so period of the judges. So we're dealing with a range of about close to 1,000 years, certainly about 800 years. And then there's, of course, this discussion whether or not he existed or whether the story ever took place. Rabbi Yosho ben Korcha omer, Iyov bimei Achashverosh haya, again, the end of the period of Tanakh. V'yesh omrim, Iyov bimei Yaakov haya. Now we scale it all the way back to Yaakov Avinu. Now, when you have this type of discrepancy within Chazal of when a story takes place, that makes you wonder, how come nobody knows? So Rambam, in his Moreh Nevuchim, uses this machloket as a springboard to where he thinks everything belongs. He thinks that one anonymous sage who says that it never took place is correct. He doesn't think that the story occurred. He doesn't imagine God really making a wager with some angelic Satan. He doesn't imagine that there was any God appearing from a whirlwind to these friends at the end of the story. He's convinced that the whole story is what we would call fiction. And in no way does that denigrate the impact of the story. His point, Rambam's point, is that this story comes to teach that, yes, there's tzaddik v'ra lo, there's righteous people who suffer needlessly and unfairly, and we have to deal with it. And so this story was written as a foil to have this conversation. So, and Rambam says the fact that Chazal have no clue when it occurred, even those who believe that it did occur, only demonstrates his position. But then he emphasizes whether or not it happened, it really doesn't matter. We're not learning this story to talk about the biography of this one very righteous man named Iyov, who poor fellow suffered very horribly. It's all about the issue. Rav Soloveitchik had a different way of describing it. I had heard it orally for many years, but now the Rav Soloveitchik has become incredibly prolific since his passing 20 years ago, and all of a sudden all of these books are coming out. So there's one called Out of the Whirlwind. And so there it's in print. So it's in one of the post-passing of Rav Soloveitchik's works, Out of the Whirlwind, where he says, actually this Talmud can be expressed in a different way. All of the views in this Talmudic passage are correct. Iyov lived in the time of Yaakov Avinu. And he lived in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. And he lived in the time of the Shofetim. And he lived in the time of Shivat Zion. And he lived in the time of the Crusades. And he lived in the time of the Spanish Inquisition and expulsion. And he lived in the time of the Holocaust. And all of the things in between. The point is that every generation has its Iyovs. This book wasn't written about one man and what happened to him. This book was written because we have a problem that we started exploring last week from the lens of Mishle, where we saw how wisdom, biblical wisdom, deals with the problem of suffering. And it has its ways of dealing with it. Sefer Iyov is a very different way of addressing the problem. By the way, based on the premise that this is not a story that took place, you understand that that's how you have a perfect man. Right? There's just no such thing. Well, I said that very clearly. There's no such thing as a perfect person. But as long as there's a real tzaddik who happens to have some minor flaws, Iyov's friends who say, oh, you deserve it, because you must have sinned somewhere, nobody's perfect, the story never gets off the ground. In order for the problem to make it to Tanakh, we have to have a fictional perfect person. How do we know he's perfect? God said he's perfect. That's why we need the story to be told the way that it is told. Chazal, by the way, have a different way of scheming how there has to be unfairness in the world. They in a way one up Tanakh in this one. It's a different approach. And that is the classic story which the Talmud tells in several places with different goals of the kid whose parent said, you know, go fetch me some eggs. And so the child goes and obeys his parents, so that's Kibbutz Avayim, which we all know gets promise of long life in the Torah. And then he shoos away the mama bird, which is yet another mitzvah for which the Torah promises long life. And then he falls out of the tree and dies. The end. That just has to happen once ever. And we have a problem. Because as we discussed last time, in order to qualify as God, you need to be able to bat 1,000. You can't have fairness most of the time and then get away with the promises that are in the Torah for long life, for fairness, for all of the things. Sefer Iyov was written because, as I mentioned last week, I'm just going to start with this conversation, the Torah addresses or solves every major theological problem that's ever been raised. It's phenomenal what it achieves. But it created this one. When you have radical monotheism, the way that we believe in it, if God is all the omnis and God is fair and God makes promises of fairness and God pays attention to our actions, then one case of a tzaddik v'ra'lo, of a righteous person who suffers unfairly, or one case of rasha v'tovo, a wicked person who is successful, that is a problem. And when there's a lot more than one case, well, then we really have a problem. So Mishlei has its method of dealing with that issue that we discussed last time. We're now going to see how Sefer Iyov deals with it. You have to look people on the street, by the way, how long is Sefer Iyov? Just stop somebody on Broadway next time you're there and just say, how long is the Book of Job? Most people would never say 42 chapters. Most people somehow have this incredibly superficial story of the guy who was righteous, suffered, and said, well, this is God's will, or something like that. Which is chapter 1, but then there's the rest of it, right? In other words, what makes this book so powerful is not... chapter 1 is very powerful too, even if that's all that there were. But the story is actually far more complex and far more powerful than all of that. And so here we're going to go through it inside. I have the English and the Hebrew as always. This time, as I mentioned last week, I don't know what the words in Hebrew mean very often. There's incredibly high and obscure poetry that is used. This week I'm actually going to read the source sheets primarily in English, except when we get back to the Talmud, I'll go back to the Hebrew. But for the biblical verses, I want to make sure to cover, this is the JPS translation, and of course you're welcome to follow along in the original Hebrew. By the way, the Hebrew is so hard, even Ezra actually suggested on Sefer Iyov that maybe the book was originally written in Aramaic and then translated into Hebrew. Which is an amazing, amazing hypothesis. He's baffled by the magnitude of difficulty of the Hebrew, although the truth is that when you translate something, typically speaking, you make it a little more understandable. In other words, it's unlikely that a translator would make it from hard Aramaic to brutally hard biblical poetry, which is what we have here. But that's his theory based on the fact that Iyov has so many difficult words. So we know that here's the frame of the story. The text just has, the source sheet just has some of the classic texts that I want to make sure that we go through inside. The story opens up with Iyov, this wonderful righteous man, and a wonderful family, and 10 kids, and he's wealthy, and everything is good. And all of a sudden the camera shifts to the heavenly host. And God is up there saying, ah, oh, I got it right with Iyov. What a wonderful and perfect man. He's so excellent. He's true to God in every way. He does everything right. And then there's that pesky Satan. You know, it's not a Satan-like figure the way that later culture is picked up on, where there was some independent evil force. The Satan in Tanakh, Satan just means impediment. And in this case, it's kind of like the prosecuting angel. In this case, he's the voice of negative within the heavenly host. And he says, God, no offense, but Iyov is not righteous at all. What are you talking about? He's so righteous. God is saying he's so righteous. He's excellent. He never makes any mistakes. You gotta love him. Well, says Satan, of course he's good, because look, he has a wonderful family and he's rich and his life is just flawless in every way. He's not righteous. He's just doing that which is prudent. If you took that stuff away from him, he would never serve you. And that's the paradox that we mentioned at the very end of last week, right? The paradox is, this isn't a solution to unfairness in the world. It's just the reality of Tanakh. We have an absolute paradox, and that's why we have this problem. The paradox is that God gave us free will. And God also promised fairness, but you see, those two, at least in the human mind, absolutely clash. Because in fact, if we always got rewarded when we did good things and always got punished when we did bad things, nobody, or at least nobody rational, would ever do the bad things. Because you get clobbered. You don't want that. So you do the good things because then you get instantly and amply rewarded. Okay, that's a very prudent thing to do. But that wouldn't be righteousness anymore. That's Satan's point. It's actually the best expression of the problem in all of Tanakh, in the mouth of the Satan. He just says, it's not righteousness if you're always doing well. Okay, so what the Satan essentially is saying is that God's price tag for giving us free will is unfairness. The world has to be unfair, because otherwise we wouldn't have any choice at all. But that means that there's unfairness, and that's the problem of the book. You know, you can't win in this one. Either we lose our free will because we would never ever be able to make a serious choice, or we lose fairness. So God is stuck in the wager and decides to make the wager with the Satan. It's like, good, take away all this stuff. I believe that he's sincere. And so he takes away all this stuff. The children die, the wealth goes, you know, pretty lightning speed disaster. And then comes the classic thing, right? Source number two. Then Job arose, tore his robe, cut off his hair, and threw himself on the ground and worshipped. He said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, naked shall I return there. The Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Adonai Natan, Adonai Lakach, Yehi Shem Adonai Mevarach. For all that, Job did not sin, nor did he cast reproach on God. First of all, what does he not say? He does not say Gamzu L'tova. Right? He doesn't say this is all for the best, or this is all God's plan and I know how it all works. He just says, look, life is very incredible. Talk about a pure philosopher here. Life is a gift. Everything that we receive is a gift. If we take our brachot seriously, every time we bite into that apple, whatever we happen to be biting into, we really believe that everything is from God. And if we don't have something, okay, so God didn't give it to us. But we have no claim, we have no entitlement. It's an incredibly sophisticated and mature philosophical position. But it's also unbelievably inhuman. He just lost 10 children. Right? It's beyond horror. And for him to just say, look, my children were a gift and now God has taken them back. I mean, we can all praise his philosophical serenity. And there's somebody once remarked that everybody who becomes a theologian should visit a child's ward in the hospital before writing any books on the subject of divine judgment. Couldn't have said it better myself. Right? In other words, Eov sounds so remarkably serene, but if the book would stop here, you would have the most inhuman person who ever lived. It cannot be that he just lost his 10 children. All he has to say is, well, they were all a gift from God. And now, may God be blessed. I'm sure he said that, I'm sure he meant it. What Sefer Eov is doing is actually setting up a journey. It's a process. It's a human process of what somebody who goes through terrible loss might do. The first thing you try to do if you're a person of faith is justify God. And so that's what he does over here. We don't sense any emotions in Eov over here. And that's chapter 1. Then comes chapter 2. At this point, God is like, okay, Satan, you owe me 5 shekels, right? You know, you lost. Eov hasn't done anything bad. He remains righteous despite the fact that he's lost everything. And Satan says, not so fast, God. Give me one more shot at him. Look, as much as he's lost his everything, he's still physically okay. Let me torture him a little. God's like, all right, fine. Go ahead. And so Eov now gets stricken with these terrible boils and is scratching himself with a lousy potsherd. I mean, it's really poor fellow. And that's what happens over here in source number 3. The adversary, that's the Satan, departed from the presence of the Lord and inflicted a severe inflammation on Job, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He took a potsherd to scratch himself as he sat in ashes. His wife said to him, you still keep your integrity. Blaspheme God and die. What's wrong with you, honey? Enough already. Just curse God. The Hebrew, by the way, what is it? She says, Barech Elohim Vamut. Tanakh is so appalled by the idea of cursing God that the expression that's used is bless God, but everybody knows what it means. It's a euphemism, but you understand the magnitude of what it would mean to actually curse God here. So Mrs. Job, this is all she says in the whole book. Right? Mrs. Job shows up at this cameo as a foil. She is describing one response to unfair calamity, and that is shallow exiting one's relationship with God. Right? And a lot of people do that, quite reasonably. In other words, I'm not justifying it, but I think it's quite reasonable for somebody to say, after this type of horror, certainly to this, this is an exaggerated case, but if one suffers needlessly and horribly, many people say, this is the moment that I walk away from God. I just don't understand how this works. I'm done. Mrs. Job represents that answer. It's a response to suffering. Job is not happy with this, and he says, you talk as any shameless woman might talk. Should we accept only good from God and not accept evil? For all that, Job said nothing sinful. And in the Hebrew, v'chol zot lo chata Iyov bishpatav. He didn't sin with his lips. Now, the Talmud, I always lament this fact, you know, like many yeshiva bachers use their thumbs when they learn Talmud. You've all seen this, right? And most of them use their thumbs wrong. Right? They just don't have the grammar of how you use your thumb or how the Talmud uses it. It looks ridiculous. I mean, you just watch them swinging their arms around like it's a shanda. So whenever I teach at YU, I make sure to give a very clear and precise grammatical lesson on how to use one's thumb so that it's actually the way that the rabbis of the Talmud use it. And I'll do the same lesson right over here. It's all in the acceleration and the timing. And if you get that, then you understand how the Talmud repeatedly uses its thumb, even in the days before they probably were actually swinging their thumbs around. For all that, Iyov did not sin with his lips. Thumb. Good use. You guys in our listening audience just missed a very important lesson. All right, now. He didn't sin with his lips, thumb, but, be the Talmud for a minute, whether or not you know what the Talmud actually does here. In his heart, he's already turbulent. That's how the Talmud reasons. Meaning, on the surface, if you just flew through these two chapters, you'd say, oh, Job is the same as he was in chapter 1. The Talmud says, uh-uh. Chapter 1, he was being the pure, inhuman religious philosopher who's just speaking God's voice. This is, everybody's a gift from God, and I have nothing more to say on the subject. May God be blessed. But in chapter 2, the Talmud already senses, okay, his mouth hasn't said anything, you know, across the foul line, but he is thinking harsh thoughts. And of course, it's not just a nice Talmudic diuk. It's not just a nice thing to read into this text. The Talmud knew what happened in chapter 3 and on when he does begin to speak. And so what we see so far is Mrs. Job represents walking away from relationship with God. In other words, if God treats you unfairly, okay, that's the moment that you give up. Job represents somebody who's going to take God on. And that's what happens in the next several chapters. What's important to note is that there is a progression. On the one hand, there's a dialogue that takes place, right? What happens is three friends, you don't want friends like these, but three friends show up, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, and they come with the best of intentions. I think that I believe that they are sweet, sincere, genuinely committed both to God and to Eo. I do. I don't think that they're being difficult. But they're not the most comforting of friends, shall we say, right? They sit around at first and they let Eov speak up first. And the way the book is structured, from chapters 3 until 31, we have a while of chapters here that we're going to boil down in the next several minutes, there's a rotating dialogue where Eov speaks, and then Eliphaz, who's friend number one, speaks in response. Then Eov gets to speak again, and then friend number two, who is Bildad, speaks next. And then Eov goes again, and then Zophar goes again. You have a couple of rounds of this. Okay? So, Eov gets to speak first. So let's look at source number 4. And he finally does speak up after having some silence with his friends. Afterward, Job began to speak and curse the day of his birth. Job spoke up and said, "Perish the day on which I was born, and the night it was announced. A male has been conceived. Mazel tov, it's a boy. Perish that day. May that day be darkness. May God above have no concern for it, and may light not shine on it." It's cursing the day he was born. He regrets ever having been alive. What doesn't he say? Notice how God isn't here, right? What Eov is doing is expressing negativity, but he's doing it in stages. It's very difficult. He's a deeply religious man who has very clear beliefs on everything, including God is fair, and he's been very grateful to God up until this point. And now he realizes that we have a problem here, right? In other words, he knows he's been innocent, and he's going to point that out time and again. And he knows that he's suffering, and since suffering also comes from God, he has a problem. But he doesn't just say, hey God, what's up? It takes him time to internalize what's going on, and it's hard to confront honestly one's feelings, especially when these feelings are going to shatter one's religious serenity. Right? In other words, he's a deeply religious man who now on a very personal level has everything he ever stood for is being threatened. So rather than just jumping right all over God, which he'll get there, it takes him some time to internalize what's really going on. So in this stage, he's just angry. I hate my life. But he doesn't yet say, I'm really angry at God. It takes him a few chapters to get there. After hating his life and expressing that, Eliphaz jumps in, and then Eo comes around in source number 5 in his second opportunity to speak. If my anguish were weighed, my full calamity laid on the scales, it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. That is why I spoke recklessly. Look, I'm miserable. What do you want? It's heavier than the sand of the sea. He's a wonderful poet, even during his suffering. For the arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit absorbs their poison. For the very first time, it takes round 2, he says, the arrows of God are in me, and I'm drinking the poison. Who is he talking to when he says this? I'll give you multiple choices. Friends or God?
Friends.
I'm talking to his friends. Now, Eliphaz said, don't, you know, this is God we're talking about here, right? You hate your life? Everything, he just upholds Eo's position. Everything is a gift from God. Perhaps you've done something to deserve this. God is always fair. You know that. I know that. Eo says, hey, I am really, really suffering here. And plus, I'm suffering because of God. That's a new level of understanding. Eo knew that from the beginning, but there's a while before it trickles from his mind until he allows himself to feel that. But what he's not doing yet is looking God in the eye and talking to God. He hasn't quite gotten there yet. In order to be able to have a full open relationship with God, one needs to be able to pray or to speak directly to God. He doesn't get there until source number 6. Finally, Eob is ready to look God in the eye. What is man that you make much of him, that you fix your attention upon him? Why, God, why are you wasting your time with me? Why are you wasting your time with any of us? You inspect him every morning, examine him every minute. Will you not look away from me for a while? Let me be till I swallow my spittle? God, give me a break. Leave me alone. If I have sinned, what have I done to you, watcher of men? Why make of me your target and a burden to myself? Eov is really beginning to flare up here. He knows that this is from God. But chapter 3, I hate my life. Chapter 6, he tells his friends, God is harming me. Chapter 7, he's ready to look God in the eye and say, this is really just not right. Even if I deserve it, which I don't, says Eo, but even if I did, God, you don't have better things to do than torture me? And slowly but surely, Eo's emotions are coming out. He's finally becoming more and more true to who he really is and what his emotions really are going on. It's a journey that he is progressing through. In source number 7, in chapter 10, as it continues through, I am disgusted with life. I will give rein to my complaints, speaking bitterness of my soul. I say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know what you charge me with. Come on, God. I'm a good lawyer, right? I'll take you. Tell me what I'm guilty of. Does it benefit you to defraud? He's telling God that he's defrauding him, right? To despise the toil of your hands while smiling on the counsel of the wicked? God, you're utterly unfair. I'm suffering and I don't deserve it, and I'll take you to court any day and win. Whereas there are plenty of wicked people out there who are doing just great. Eo is now looking God in the eye and is able to say, God, you are unfair, which of course is what's happening in the book. That's the whole point of the book. But for the first time he's doing it. It's important to note somewhere in this discussion that not only is Eo fictional, but he's a fictional non-Jew. He doesn't seem to be Jewish. There's nothing in this story which remotely indicates that he is Jewish. And most of our Mefarshim assume that this story is being told about somebody as though he is not Jewish. And his friends, for that matter, also not Jewish. The reason why the story has to be told this way is because, again, when dealing with biblical wisdom is for all Yirei Shamayim. Just like we talked about with Mishlei. Mishlei is nothing specifically Jewish. Its author was Jewish, and same thing here, right? But there's nothing specifically Jewish to wisdom. It's all about what it takes to be a Yirei Shamayim. So in the case of Mishlei, it has its principles of how all God-fearing people should see the world. And in the case of Sefer Iyov, the problem is that all God-fearing people have this problem of tzadik v'ra'lo, when bad things happen to good people. So Iyov here is getting increasingly hostile towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu because he feels completely wronged. By the time we get to chapter 19, he's just as open as he's ever going to need to be. Source number 8, just a sample of that. Yet know that God has wronged me. He has thrown up siege works around me. I cry violence, but I am not answered. I shout, but can get no justice. He has barred my way, I cannot pass. He has laid darkness upon my path. He kindles anger against me. He regards me as one of his foes. Eov is devastated. And now he's able to just say exactly what he's probably been feeling all along, but it took him several rounds of dialogue to be able to get that all out. And here you really see the journey of the God-fearing person who's in the horns of a terrible struggle with God and is honest enough to be able to do that. Mrs. Eov gave him prudent advice in the sense that he's never going to get any answers. He knows that. And he laments the fact that God is never going to... God, if you ever were to show up, I'll take you. But I don't think you're going to come, and I'm getting really frustrated by that. But he never walks away. Right? He's yelling at God, he's angry at God, he views God, he thinks, is being incredibly unfair, but he's there. It's a very different approach from that of Mrs. Eov, who just says a few words and then vanishes from the story. And I get to share with you my all-time, not my all-time, but one of my top several verses in all of Tanakh. We're in the middle of this very powerful story, and if we were to read it systematically, cover to cover, it would become even more so. You know, it's round after round, and you just watch Eov's temper and his emotions just welling up more and more. I'm just giving a few samples to give a sense of what the development is in a summary sort of way. But usually when you have a story like this in Tanakh, the author doesn't peek out at you. You just hear the story. In other words, we're absorbed in the plot. We're absorbed in the characters. We feel his pain. Then in source number 9, later on in the same chapter from the previous source, oh, that my words were written down. I wish somebody were to write a book about this. Right? Here's the author saying, hi. Right? The author is just saying, you know, this is why I'm writing this book. Because I realize that everybody, nobody struggles as much as you, or very few people suffer to that extent in most normal societies. But people suffer, and they suffer unfairly, and they certainly witness suffering that seems to be unfair. And that's why Eov, you know, put in Eov's mouth, I wish that this book would be written down. Would they were inscribed in a record? I wish that there could be a record of this for all time. And of course, here the author is just letting us know, I'm doing this because I realize that this is everybody's problem. Whether or not they're going through the exact suffering that Eov goes through, chas v'shalom, rachman al-islan, but even lesser sufferings, there's still very much of that. So what are Eov's friends doing? Eov's friends, again, there are three of them. There's Eliphaz, and there's Bildad, and there's Zophar. They're the three, and they go in rounds. Even though they basically have the same approach to Eov. They say, Eov, we're religious people, you are a religious person. We all agree, God supervises our actions, and God is fair. You agree with all of the premises, and you're just saying you never sinned. And therefore, this is unfair and undeserved. We think that that's impossible. We think that you must have sinned. No offense. We're sorry you're suffering so much. It's terrible. Either you sin, maybe your kid sinned. I don't know. But God doesn't do things that are undeserved. God is fair. So I'm sorry. You know, in the tzadik v'ra'lo equation, right? There's tzadik v'ra'lo. So the way that the friends answer the question is, you're not really a tzadik. Meaning, you might be 99% a tzadik, but you're not 100, and therefore that's why there's no problem of tzadik v'ra'lo. Another approach, which none of the characters take, is gamzu l'tova. It's not really ra. Right? It's not really bad. You thought it was bad because you have the wrong perspective, but if you had a global, divine perspective, you would realize that that was good for you. Nobody in Sefer Iyov adopts that approach, but it's on the books, right? There's Nachumish Gamzu named that because that was his approach within the Talmud, that things are all for the good. But nobody in Sefer Iyov takes that approach. As long as we're on the subject of things that nobody does in Sefer Iyov, nobody says, you know, Iyov, maybe you're right. Maybe you really never sinned, and we all would agree that you're suffering pretty horribly. But wait till you get to heaven. Things will be phenomenal. You'll love it. You must have the biggest chelik in Olam Haba. You're going to be next to Moshe Rabbeinu. Only other way to explain it. Nobody uses that answer. None of the friends, with all of their fishing around for every possible justification of what's going on, none of them appeals to afterlife for the very simple reason. Tanakh's premise of fairness is this worldly fairness. Afterlife is never an available option within Tanakh because God promises fairness in this world. And so it wasn't until Sefer Daniel that problem became, which is all the way at the end of Tanakh, where the problem of unfairness in this world became so unbearable. We believed in afterlife forever, but afterlife was never used as a solution to the problem of unfairness because God promises fairness for this world. All the brachot and klalot are this worldly. Right? And there's nothing about if you do this and that mitzvot or all of them, then you get a great share in the world to come. There's none of that. It's simply not the way Torah talks. It wasn't until Sefer Daniel, the very, very end of Tanakh, and for that matter, the end of Sefer Daniel, the last chapter of it, chapter 12, that for the very first time in biblical history, it's the resurrection that is invoked, what we call Tziyat HaMetim, is invoked to solve the problem of, or at least to address the problem of unfairness. Yes, the world is unfair, finally, Sefer Daniel concedes, but when God resurrects the dead in the what we call Yemot HaMashiach, then the righteous people will finally get their proper reward and the wicked people will finally get punished properly. That's the very first time that anybody ever did that. At least within our tradition. I can't promise you that it's that nobody elsewhere did it, but nobody else has a problem besides us good radical monotheists. Right, once that came onto the books, in the apocryphal period, you have some book called The Wisdom of Solomon. They tried to pawn it off as something written by Shlomo HaMelech. He didn't write it. But the Wisdom of Solomon is the very first time in Jewish literature. It's Jewish, it's not no Ruach HaKodesh, it's not part of Tanakh. Righteous people get heaven. And that explains unfairness. It's the very first time that you have that as an answer used. And then by the time of Chazal, that becomes a very more widespread approach. So much so that, you know, like what did all the rest of Chazal do with the kid who falls out of the tree after honoring his parents and chewing away the mommy bird? What, you know, Elisha ben Avuya defected from our faith over that story, according to some Talmudic renditions of what's going on over there. What did the rest of Chazal do, and what do we do? Because that kid really does fall out of the tree. This is a real problem. Right? So they said, after going, it's of all places, Masechet Chulin, it's all the laws of Kashrut. Right, so the very last stuff, meaning right before you go, Hadran Alach Masechet Chulin, right there, they talk about this kid that fell out of the tree, and they go through all the classic answers that had always been used, and why they all fail. And none of the classical answers solve this kid falling out of the tree, and they finally conclude, basically, okay, this world is unfair, we need to depend on an afterlife to solve this problem. They say it in a more colorful way, that is essentially what's happening over there. That is a big, big deal. To actually conceive this world is unfair is very different from what Sefer Iyov is trying to do, which is to struggle with the problem. Right? In the time of Tanakh, an afterlife was not an available way of addressing this. We have to struggle with it in one form or another. But once the afterlife comes into the picture, I can't imagine not thinking about afterlife as part of it because, of course, we're Chazal Jews. We follow what Chazal and later Mefarshim taught. But it's important to note that Iyov's friends do not invoke that argument because it simply was not available. It was not within the wavelength of how Tanakh thought about this problem. The three friends have a similar approach, but they actually have different styles. Rav Amos Chacham, in his introduction to Dat Mikra, points this out. Eliphaz claims prophecy. He claims to have been a prophet. And the idea is that this is prophecy's response to Tzadik V'Ra'lo. Bildad doesn't claim prophecy, but he claims to be schooled in the schools of wisdom, exactly what we talked about with Mishlei last week. He was a sage. And so he gave a similar answer, but from the perspective of a sage. So far, doesn't claim to be a prophet, doesn't claim to be a sage. He's just a good ma'amin. He's a good, I would call him a poshada yid, but he's not a yid. He's a poshada yirei shamayim non-Jew, right? He has pure faith in God. And so he speaks in the name of pure faith. He says, look, I don't have prophecy, I don't have wisdom, but I believe that God is fair, and therefore it must be that you've done something wrong that you do not wish to concede. Well, after round upon round upon round of the friends pouring onto Iyov and blasting Iyov after a while for being obnoxious, it's like, how dare you challenge God to a trial? Who do you think you are? You must have sinned. Just deal with it, Iyov. face up to yourself, be self-honest, don't be so self-deceptive, nobody's perfect. And Yov tells them that he's not really happy with their friendship and wishes to turn in his card. And he becomes increasingly hostile to God also. So that covers us chapters 1 through 31. Then comes chapter 32, and something interesting happens, which we will find about right after this water break. Some other guy shows up named Elihu. And Elihu, talk about getting the mic, he goes on for 6 chapters in a row, from chapters 32 to 37. I don't know if he's a friend, I don't know who this guy is, but he shows up and breaks the circle of rounds, which we've been seeing up until now. And Elihu has a very different voice from the other three friends. He has a different point of view. He starts off by saying, God is beyond our understanding. That's already different from what Eov and the friends thought. They all believe that they understand how God works, namely God judges the world and God is fair. Since that is the case, Eov is furious because he thinks that God has been unfair to him, and the friends are calm because they say, well, actually, no, we're sure that God is fair and you're wrong. But they all agree on the rule. Elihu shows up and says, who says that we understand God's rules so well? How can we put God in a box that we just can pin down exactly how it goes? That's point number one that he makes. Point number two is, God doesn't owe anybody anything. That's also very different from what Eov and the friends all think. Right? They all think that God does. If you do, God does owe things. If you do good things, then God owes you good things in return. If you do bad things, God owes you bad things in return. Elihu says God doesn't owe anybody anything. God is God. He's beyond us. He then argues that God generally is fair, but let's say you suffer without sin, he says. Okay, so it's an opportunity for you to get closer to God through a crisis. Wow, that's a brand new piece of news as far as I'm concerned. This is a totally different approach from everything that we've seen up until now. Because Elihu actually grants the point that Eov really, really, really might be suffering though he has not sinned. And the reason why this is so interesting is because you and I, as readers of the story, know that to be correct. How do we know? Because God said so. Right? Eov isn't privy. The characters in the story are not privy to the God-Satan dialogue at the beginning of the story. But we are privy to it. That's the advantage. We get to be the omniscient readers. We're so smart. Because the narrator has clued us in that God himself has testified on Eov's behalf that Eov is perfect. And that means that when Elihu, just as a human being, comes in there and says it's possible to suffer without any sin at all, we're nodding our heads. Eov is actually caught in a very funny place, because on the one hand, that's what he thinks is happening, right? He's suffering without having sinned. But the difference is that Elihu isn't surprised, whereas Eov sure is, right? Eov thinks, wait a minute, this is against my understanding of God. Elihu is saying, you don't understand, you can't have a full understanding of God. That's Elihu's chidush to this discussion. Eov's protest stems from the point of his belief in God's hashgacha, and his supervision, and in his fairness. That's Eov's whole protest in the story, is rooted in that belief. And now Elihu is saying, you should believe in God, but you can't know how God works. And that's a very different point of view, and incidentally, it's a point of view which is very close to the heart of the story. So Elihu doesn't try to give an answer, some pat answer to Eov, saying, look, Eov, God doesn't quite work the way that you think, but here's why you're probably suffering. He just says, look, I don't know how God works, neither do you, neither do your friends. We owe everything to God, we are grateful to God. Sometimes people suffer without sin, in which case we just use that as an impetus to grow, and we should obey God regardless. That's something very, very, very different from what everybody has said. And we're going to get back to Elihu's point. What is critical is that Eov never responds to Elihu. Eov probably doesn't even know what to do with himself right now, because his friends and he were on the same page. They had the exact same belief system. And the only thing that Eov had over his friends is that he knew that he was innocent. But they had shared the same beliefs. Here comes Elihu saying, actually, guys, your beliefs are, you might be right, you might be wrong, we just don't know how God works. But you can't protest against God over that. You just simply don't know. Now, by the way, I'm actually kind of bummed that the Satan never comes back into the book. I'm really bummed, actually. I would have liked it for him to come, because I'll tell you when he would have come. In chapter 27. Chapter 27 is once and for all when God wins the bet. And I would have loved it if right there, the camera shifted back over, and after Job said this, God told the Satan, you lose, pal, right? Or something like that. It would have been amazing. Because what does Eov say in chapter 27? It's so fantastic. In source number 10. This is still in the middle of the round with the friends. Job again took up his theme and said, by God who has deprived me of justice, I swear by the unfair God of the world, right? By Shaddai who has embittered my life. As long as there is life in me and God's breath is in my nostrils, my lips will speak no wrong, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me to say you are right. God, I'll never grant ever that you are right and I am wrong. I'm right, says Job, says Eov. And you're wrong, God. Until I die, I will maintain my integrity. I persist in my righteousness and will not yield. I shall be free of reproach as long as my life. God, you are so unfair, but I swear by you, the unfair God, I will always be a tzaddik. I will never walk away from my relationship with you. That's the moment where the Satan loses the bet. Because that's the moment where Eov demonstrates point blank that his righteousness does not stem from the happy life that he had prior to chapter 1. His righteousness stems from a belief that righteousness is good. It is an inherent value. And this statement of Eov is one of the best statements you'll find anywhere in Tanakh, where he calls God unfaithful and unfair. And he swears by that unfaithful and unfair God that he will always be a servant of God. You don't get any higher than that. That's where Eov can walk away feeling I'm a tzaddik, and even again, he doesn't have to feel that way from any self-righteous point of view, but God would be able to turn to the Satan and say, here's a man who views tikkun as an inherent good. It's not because of the benefits which he receives. So that's chapters 1 through 37. We're doing very well. We got 5 chapters to go and about 10 minutes to do it. I think our proportions are good in terms of the timing. Chapters 38 through 41, something completely unexpected happens in the book, which is God shows up and talks. You know, in books of prophecy, God does communicate with Nevi'im, and we're used to that over there. But in our story, Eov's whole problem was challenging God to a duel, so to speak, or to a trial, knowing that God isn't going to come. Because why should God come? When we suffer, God doesn't show up and explain anything. Here, all of a sudden, God shows up. And he speaks in a tirade for 4 chapters long, which all boils down to what he says at the very beginning. Source number 11. Then the Lord replied to Eov out of the tempest and said, who is this who darkens counsel, speaking without knowledge? Gird your loins like a man. Okay, Eov, tough guy. You're challenging me to a trial? Okay, I'm here. You want a trial? Go ahead. You can go first. I will ask and you will inform me. I'll take some answers from you, Eov. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Speak if you have understanding. Do you know who fixed its dimensions, who measured it with a line, etc.? God shows up and says, all right, Eov, hotshot, you're challenging me to a trial and you're calling me unfair. You're treating me as an equal here. But guess what? I'm God and you're not. Right? I created the cosmos. Where were you? Do you have any understanding of anything, Eov? And for 4 chapters, he just clobbers Eov. Now, I guess living in the 21st century, what I'm picturing here is that Eov and the 3 friends, and if Elihu stuck around him too, so everybody's, you know, lying on the ground, faces, to, you know, in awe of God. They cannot believe that God has shown up here. And God is going on and on and on about how arrogant Eov was for challenging him to a trial. Now, how could he possibly know? I'm picturing that Eov is probably feeling very small right now. Now, I bet you Eliphaz and Bildad, who are probably very near each other, are in awe of God and they're giving each other a high five. They're like, ha, Eov, we told you. You didn't believe us, but now God is telling you off like you've never been told off by anybody. You're right. Hmm? They're very pleased with themselves. They're probably, you know, in awe as with everybody else. But they finally are vindicated. And when we think about who's the role model, the religious role model of the story? God's tirade against Eov certainly speaks to the idea that it looks like the friends were right all along. Eov shouldn't have protested. Or even if you feel sympathy that he suffered so much, it was human, okay, but he was wrong and needs to do teshuvah right now. And the friends are probably thinking the exact same thing. And then we all wait for Eov. Eov gets a chance to respond here after four chapters of God yelling at him. And he says in source number 12, God said in reply to the Lord, I know that you can do everything, that nothing you propose is impossible for you. Who is this that obscures counsel without knowledge? I'm such an idiot, says Eov. I cannot believe that I had the chutzpah to challenge God like this. Indeed, I spoke without understanding of things beyond me, which I did not know. God, you make a good point. You're God, I'm not. Hear now, and I will speak. I will ask, and you will inform me. I had heard you with my ears, but now I see you with my eyes. Therefore, I recant and relent, being but dust and ashes. Eov is completely overwhelmed by what has happened, and it's hard to imagine not feeling very similar. You know who's angry at him, by the way? Elie Wiesel. He is so disappointed at Eov's backing down here. It's like, come on, he should have stuck for it. He should have stood strong against God. He was right. And obviously, Elie Wiesel, of all people, certainly has not only the right to criticize Eov like that, but obviously he has the internal experience that makes him feel that Eov kind of is a landsman in a certain sense. Like, here's another person who suffered such brutality unfairly. Eov should have stood against God here. He should have held his own. But Eov does not. He backs down. And at least the way, from somebody who didn't go through what Elie Wiesel went through, I sympathize with him. If God is yelling at you directly and he's in the living room with you, it's really, really hard to come up with a witty comeback, right? It's really hard. I understand why Eov is going to be completely overwhelmed at this moment. And of course, if the book stopped here, I think the point of the book would be, Eov suffered, it was unfair, we agree that it was unfair because the narrative told us that, but he went over the top, he was way too harsh towards God, the friends were trying to get him into line, they did an excellent job, kudos to them for sticking up for the truth, and now at least in the end, Eov backed down, the end. That would be an excellent summary. See, when you make source sheets, though, you've got to make sure to separate verses 1 through 6 and to put that in source number 12, and then make sure that the very next verse is in another source, as in the next one, because you lose the drama of what's about to happen if you put it all together. So let's look at the very next verse, source number 13. After the Lord has spoken these words to Job, then comes the biggest turnaround ever, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, I am incensed at you and your two friends, for you have not spoken the truth about me, as did my servant Eov. Hello. Talk about way to turn that one around, like way big, right? In other words, had this verse not been here, I would have walked away saying, okay, the message of the story is Eov was unwise in his tirade, he was arrogant. Whereas now he's saying Eov was right all along, and you guys, who do you think you are? You have to repent. Who do you think you are that you know how I work? In other words, exactly what Elihu told everybody, right? Elihu was saying, we just don't know how God works. Now God is saying, people, you don't know how God works. Stop putting God in a box. This changes everything, because suddenly Eov is called Avdi. That's the highest compliment anybody can get in Tanakh. To be called Eved Hashem, and not only to be called that, but to be called that by Hashem. Pretty good. In other words, he's saying, Eov is the best. Eov is the true righteous individual here, and you guys don't know what you're talking about. That changes the whole tone of the book. In fact, halakha, this isn't a halachic man book, but the Gemara often does focus on halachic man terminology. And when they talk about ona'at devarim, verbal abuse, they have to give examples of what verbal abuse is. So in source number 14, they pass in, Hamani mekayim lo tanu yishadam mito. What does it mean to not wrong one another? Ona'at. Ona'at devarim, talking about verbal affliction or verbal abuse. What is verbal abuse? Hakesad. Im ayu yisurim ba'in alav. Let's say somebody suffers. Im ayu falaim ba'in alav, or he gets ill. Oshaya mechaver banav, or he's burying his children. Al yomar lo kederech shamru lo chaverav Eov. Do not speak to such an individual the way that Eov's friends spoke to Eov. Chazal are postening the halacha that what Eov's friends did is ona'at devarim, it's verbal abuse, to come and say, I'm sorry you're suffering, but you probably deserve it. And this becomes the din, right? It's an amazing use of our narrative, which is, world of religious theology, and converting it into, as Chazal are going to do, because for us halacha is so central to how we live religious theology. You're not allowed to behave like Eov's friends. That's amazing. Chazal very much understands, not only is it a role model issue and what the right response is, but it's exactly the point. We're not allowed to be like Eov's friend. And that's, of course, the point of the book. The point of the book is that Eov represents the right response. Right? Mrs. Eov represents the wrong response, walking away from God. Eov's friends, as pious as they are, represent the wrong response because they claim to know how God works. And by the way, a lot of people today also claim to know how God works. They don't. But they claim it, right? People of all different faith communities, and they just get up there and say exactly why things happen. And God himself is saying, you just can't know me because I happen to be God and I'm far beyond any box that you could put me in. Chazal take that profound lesson one step further and just a little authorship comment. Miktavani, source number 15. Chazal discussed the authorship of the book. Who wrote this book? There are different opinions, by the way, but this opinion is from the Brita already. Moshe Katav Sifro, what you and I call the Torah. Parashat Bil'am, why those chapters in Sefer Bamidbar are counted as something different over there. Really interesting, but really for another time. The Eov. According to this source, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote Eov. The reason why it's curious and important for Moshe Rabbeinu, at least in theory, to have written Sefer Eov is because he had the right Rebbe to ask, why do good things happen to bad people and why do bad things happen to good people? Right? You and I have a conversation, we could speculate, we could say we don't know, we can do whatever we want, but we don't know. But Moshe Rabbeinu could talk to somebody who did. And so Chazal actually bring that up as a hypothetical in Brachot Zayin Amud Aleph. The Gemara has hardly gotten off the ground, right? We're just six daps in, and they already raised the question. One view is that Moshe Rabbeinu asked God, why do bad things happen, if you read the Sugya, why do bad things happen to good people, and why do good things happen to bad people? And God answered him. And the answer, by the way, I don't know if you'll find this very satisfying, intergenerational punishments and reward solves all. Meaning, why does a good person suffer? Because his father must have been rotten, so poor kid is suffering those father's sins. Why is the Rasha doing so well? Because his father or grandfather must have been good, so he's getting reaping the benefits from that. That's the answer given in the Gemara, according to the view that Moshe Rabbeinu got an answer. If you are satisfied with that, good. If not, then join me to Pliga de Rabbi Meir, Damar Rabbi Meir, Shayim Netanelo V'achad La Netanelo. Rabbi Meir says God never answered Moshe Rabbeinu. Rabbi Meir's Rebbe was who? It was Elisha ben Avuya. Rabbi Meir, the student of Elisha ben Avuya, is saying, like, look, my Rebbe was right. There really is unfairness in this world. And not only is he right about that, but nobody, not even Moshe Rabbeinu, had an answer to that. It was beyond prophecy, let alone beyond human wisdom. My Rebbe was wrong in walking away. Right? In other words, Rabbi Meir remains a Tana. He doesn't become Acher too. He remains one of the greatest of the Tanaim because he said we have to do what Eov did. Right? Eov stood by God despite looking God in the eye and saying, I see unfairness. And what the Gemara is saying in Rabbi Meir's name here is God wouldn't answer Moshe Rabbeinu. It's beyond prophecy. That's an incredible, incredible, very profound discussion in the Talmud, but it brings home why Eov is one of the greatest books ever written. How courageous is it to have within Tanakh, and according to the Brita over there that we looked at in Bava Batra, written by Moshe Rabbeinu himself, is Moshe Rabbeinu saying, we don't have answers to this problem. And this is the same Moshe Rabbeinu who got from HaKadosh Baruch Hu the Torah. And within Tanakh itself, the Ruach HaKodesh, we have included a book saying, we don't know. But the right response is to do what Eov did, which is to go through this terrible process, right? Terrible process of first religious philosopher to starting to have turbulent emotions, to being just upset about life, to realizing, wait a second, this is all from God, I have a problem here, to having a rupture in the relationship with God, to finally coming around and building a stronger relationship with God than ever, and a very different, it'll never go back to being what it was pre-chapter one, but a very different relationship. And, you know, there are many reasons why one might be happy to be Jewish. One of them, for me, is that there is a Sefer Eov. Because I think we all go through, whether or not we've personally suffered in a dramatic sort of way, we all see stuff that's just unfathomable. Whether reading newspapers, internet, or just in our own communities or our own families. And yes, there are always pat answers that can be given, and there always are pat answers that have been given, just as Eov's friends represent. And in our day and age too, people always seem to have a pat answer for things. It's good to know that the Ruach HaKodesh, and even ascribed to Moshe Rabbeinu, is just a very clear statement, which is a counterbalance within Tanakh, which is, we stand by God, we trust in God, But we are not going to say Gamzu L'Tova. We're not going to say this is all for the best. It might be, but we have no way of knowing that. And it might really be unfair. And that just changes the whole game. It transforms Emunah from a child Emunah to an adult Emunah. It's much harder to have this adult Emunah, but thank God it exists, because I think a lot of us would have walked away were it not for the fact that Sefer Iyov came along and said, this is also the heart and soul of Judaism is found within Tanakh. And so bless the authors of Sefer Iyov and the canonizers of Tanakh for including it in there. And I thank you all once again for coming. Next week, God willing, we'll deal with Kohelet, which touches on this issue as well, but he has a much broader agenda than Sefer Iyov, which is all about Tani Peralo, and I look forward to learning with you next week. Thank you so much for coming. We have time for a couple of questions.
Then again, God didn't come and talk to Elie Wiesel, and even though God didn't answer Eov, the fact that God himself comes and talks means that you don't really need an answer to him. Elie Wiesel didn't have an answer.
Of course you're right. And by the way, I don't know if I emphasize this enough, just that you hit on what I think is the most important thing. As much as God berates Eov for who do you think you are, you didn't create the world, he never says, by the way, here's why you're suffering. He doesn't give the answer, because there is no answer to give him. You're right. I don't stand in judgment of anybody who went through the Holocaust ever just because they went through an unspeakable experience. I understand why Elie Wiesel is frustrated with Eov, because he obviously doesn't feel like he's dust and ashes. He challenges God very directly in many of his writings. What one should or should not do is a personal faith discussion. What I'm interested in Sefer Iyov is that Iyov backs down because God overwhelms him. But then God turns around and says, but he was right. So I'm not answering your question because I don't know how to take on Elie Wiesel on this issue. I mention it because I think it's very powerful that he obviously takes this particular question very personally and understandably, and in a way that hopefully we never, ever, ever will be able to fully understand.
But as you said, you don't walk around saying Gamzu
L'Tova,
but Gamzu
L'Tova was Rabbi Akiva. He got that name because that was his trademark. Rabbi Akiva did it also.
He's not big enough, he's not holy enough, he's not far-sighted enough to say Gamzu L'Tova, but everyone's supposed to say Kol Davin Mishmaya L'Tanakh.
Correct. Good. Yes?
Do you have any opinion about why the majority of post-Holocaust writing from the yeshiva world, Rabbanan, seems to totally reject the Ethiopian solution as opposed to the Jews must have sinned, that's why...
It's a classical answer on the book, and don't forget, it's a poll within Torah, right? What I'm interested is in the dialectic. If Eov didn't exist, then we would all have to say that sort of approach, because that's what the Torah does.
Safer.
Huh?
So why does one go to the pre-Eov answer?
Oh, I'm not satisfied with it. In fact, it causes me a good deal of chagrin, right? With all great respect to the individuals who say these things, it's hard to fathom to me how somebody can claim to know why the Holocaust happened, right? So it causes me a lot of pain. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, we'll quote somebody who's a lot, a true giant in this issue. We asked him that question, years ago. And I'd never seen him get so worked up in a response. Usually he has a very, straightforward way of presenting. He got very, very angry at those who would presume to know God's mind on this particular issue. And understandably, it really resonated in terms of the power of his response. So I have a hard time fathoming it, but I also understand from time immemorial we've been giving answers like that. Yeah.
You mentioned in Tanakh there's no reliance on the answer of an Olam Haba. But you mentioned that they all believed it?
Yeah, and as belief in afterlife is ancient. It didn't get made up in Sefer Daniel. Yeah. There's all kinds of good stuff written about it now. We'll talk about it afterwards. But it's alluded. The point is that it's always alluded to and assumed rather than if you do the mitzvot, you will go to heaven. There's no explicit statement of that variety anywhere in Tanakh and certainly not in the Torah. But there are allusions after allusions that you see very well. They certainly believed in an afterlife. It's just that it's a very loosely defined concept within Tanakh. You can't pin down what the biblical view of afterlife is because there's so little explicit about it.
Yeah, I kind of remember a medrash that we used to say often at the Seder, that Paro had three advisors, one being Bilam, the other one being Geo,
right,
and one being Yisro. Bilam said, actually got Moshe to kill him, and Geo shut up, he was quiet, and Yisro said not to do anything. And in any case, the Medrash seems to say that because he was quiet that he got this little bit of punishment. Is that a real Medrash?
Well, it's in Sotah Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, so it's there.
Why?
It's in Masechet Sotah, so in the Gemara, Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, you can look it up at home. And so it's definitely there. It's not just one of these things that kind of gets bandied around and stuff like that. But it's certainly not shot in Sefer Iyov, meaning the whole point of Sefer Iyov is that Iyov did nothing wrong and that there's unjust suffering. That's the point of the book. That story might very well be teaching us about, you know, the so-called silent majorities who allow evil to develop instead of protesting it, like good old Yitro did, right? Yitro was a hero for standing up, even though it cost him his livelihood and he had to run away. But he's a hero, as opposed to most people who, okay, they're not actively evil like a Bilam, but they remain silent in the face of evil, and that allows evil to happen. It teaches a very powerful lesson, which I think is still very relevant, but it's a different lesson from that of Sefer Iyov.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a bona fide Gemara, yeah.
So in other words, it's saying that you could almost be a tzaddik gemur, but still, because you don't protest, you're worthy of punishment.
Correct. In other words, it's a very activist Gemara trying to say that very often people stay silent in the face of evil, and that allows evil to persist. The reason why Paro was able to be enslave a nation is not just because of the evil advisors like Bilam who said, go do it, but because of all the quiet, good do-gooders who just stayed out of the way like Eo. If there had been more protesters like Yitro, it wouldn't have happened. So I think it's a very important lesson too, but a different one from Sefer Eo.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you once again. I look forward to seeing you next week.